Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to open a public hearing in the subcommittee of the House Committee on Water. Until such time as we get a quorum, in which case we'll gavel it in as a quorum and the full committee will be here. And with that, any announcements, Cindy, that we have before we begin our agenda?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, just so you know, testimony that we have received since last Wednesday are the documents with the rubber band around them. And we will be acknowledging them as submitted testimony in the minutes today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, then, let's move quickly to the two ladies, I think, that were here last week and said they would hold over till today. April Love and Lois, is it Barron?
Yes, thank
you. Would you like to come up and have a seat? And we'll start off with April, if you would, please.
I thought I'd go through this notebook.
Yeah. Staff.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Water Committee. I'm April Love. I'm like many people who are passionate about fluoridation. I came to Oregon from a fluoridated state. I was a hygienist in Detroit, Michigan for the first 12 years of fluoridation and began to see the difference in the decay rate in our young patients, much different than my own experience with decay. After dental school, I came to Oregon to be a hospital dental resident at OHSU. That's where I learned that tooth decay wasn't just a disease of the teeth, but could have a devastating negative effect on the whole body. For example, we had a young diabetic woman who almost died before we discovered her oral infection. A teenage boy lost his transplanted kidney. A woman had a brain abscess, and two young men had to have artificial heart valves because of the dental infections. An older lady who had radiation for throat cancer lost her jaw because of an abscessed tooth. This was high dental drama you never hear about. Following my hospital stint, I started a practice in downtown Portland. I had a lot of patients who grew up out of the state, and like most dentists, it got to be really easy to tell who grew up with fluoridated water and who didn't.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
We're going to close the subcommittee and open the full committee and the public hearing on water fluoridation bill by the full committee. Please go ahead.
Okay. Because it was obvious that patients didn't love having their teeth worked on, I was aggressive with fluoride. Tablets for kids, rinses for adults, concentrated fluoride toothpaste for usually older people taking medication that made their mouth dry. After 20 years, I retired thinking that Mr. Tooth Decay was pretty much under control. And then I volunteered to do dental screenings for the Head Start program in Washington County. I was shocked. I had no idea that our low-income kids had such horrible teeth. I have now screened. This is an example of the kids that I see. It was in the pamphlet that I brought in last week. It's in the middle of the one talking about tooth decay. These are the kids that I see. These are the kids I saw 2 years ago. I have now screened thousands of Head Start kids and hundreds of second and third graders for sealant programs. It's always the same. 60 to 70% of the kids I see have cavities or fillings. This is three times the national average. These are Oregon kids, not Canadian, not European, not from Africa, not from India. These are Oregonians. So I thought, I'm a dentist. I can fix these kids. I volunteered to be on the Northwest Medical Team van, went out to the Hillsborough Head Start School, and the kids started crying when they saw that van pull into the parking lot. They cried all the while I was working on them, and they were crying when they left. And who can blame them? This little girl here, when I have to fix her teeth, I have to give her two shots right above these two front teeth, and I don't know whether you've ever had shots up there, but it hurts even to give them. And then I pull these teeth out. And then this tooth that can be fixed, I have to put on that tooth a drill that goes 300,000 RPM. And this is a three-year-old. I'd be lucky if I can get this done. A lot of these kids have to be sedated, and some have to go to the hospital. And when they go to the hospital, and if they're not on OHP, it requires voluntary time from a dentist, volunteer space from the hospital, the anesthesiologist. It's incredibly expensive. So what is the result? Well, without those two front teeth, this little girl who's learning how to speak can't articulate well, so people can't understand her. So she stops talking. She stops smiling, so her socialization skills are diminished. It's hard to bite food, and so nutrition suffers. And the worst thing for me is that she's going to hate to go to the dentist. And what I've found in my 20 years of practice is that when people become dental phobics, they also tend not to take care of themselves and take care of their teeth. So you think, what kind of head start are we giving this little girl? This is the saddest thing I've ever done, and while I'm doing it, I think, how stupid. This is preventable. It doesn't have to happen. It reminds me of the polio epidemic when I was a little kid. It's like the government saying, well, polio doesn't kill that many people. They're only crippled. Why bother with prevention? Let's just wait till people are crippled, and then we'll give them braces and crutches. And then last year, I want to show you this.
Oh, good amount to play with. Set of teeth.
The reason I'm showing you this is that it's so difficult for those of us who look in mouths for a living to actually translate what we see to the people who don't have that experience. So I worked at a Job Corps center last year, and this is Sam, not his real name. He was a student in my patient. Job Corps, which is a program paid by taxpayers, is designed to train young people so they can get a job and become responsible taxpayers themselves. But look at that. What kind of job do you think Sam can get?
Mr. Yeah. Chair, briefly, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Forgive me if you said this and I was distracted by this. How old is this person?
I'm going to tell you at the end.
Oh, excuse me. I didn't miss it.
Yeah. And what kind of socialization skills do you think he has? How easy would it be for him to comply with the new nutrition guidelines of eating 9 servings of fruit and vegetables a day? A banana is a challenge for Sam. And then there's a broader social issue. Job Corps has a limited amount of money that they will spend for dental care for their students. Because of the time and the money that I spent on Sam, I had less opportunity to work on many of the other students that also needed help. This could describe the Oregon Health Plan. And what contributed to Sam's problem? He was 20 years old, and I was his first dentist. So that's why I'm involved in the fluoridation issue. I know that even if drinking fluoridated water doesn't totally eliminate the decay I see, it would at least make it more manageable. Children would get fewer cavities, get them at a later age, the decay would progress slower, and the effects would be much less profound. There are hundreds of people in Oregon who are working on prevention programs, programs of education, xylitol gum, fluoride varnish, sealants, and fluoride supplements, and the ODA is working to get soft drinks out of schools. But it isn't enough. We need a better start for our kids. So 3 years ago, I joined Stanford Children, and we hit the local city councils. That's when I discovered that there was actually opposition to fluoridation. What we heard was scary, and we didn't know if what was being said was true or not. Even though I believed in the dental benefits of fluoride, I'm a healthcare professional. How could I support something that could cause harm? We scrutinized everything we could get our hands on that had been published, both for and against fluoridation. That's how this notebook evolved. In addition, because of the lead and arsenic scare, we had the tap water tested in an old house that had been getting fluoridated water for 40 years. Results of that test, one part per million of fluoride and no evidence of lead or arsenic. Because of the claim that there is abundant fluoride in our food, we had that tested too. Yes, there's fluoride in food, but not enough to make much difference. So after our due diligence, our conclusion was 170 million people in this country, including 750,000 Oregonians, drink fluoridated water. After almost 60 years of research and experience, there is no reputable evidence, either double-blind or epidemiological, that in the United States, fluoride added to the drinking water at optimal concentration has ever harmed humans, the environment, our pet cats and dogs. Balancing this against the reality that tooth decay definitely causes harm and even can cause death makes water fluoridation essential for all our citizens. So, here we are. We pro-fluoridationists focus on the disease that fluoride can help prevent, and the people who oppose it focus on the disease that they are afraid that it can cause. Last week when I first spoke to my representative, Jerry Crummo, he asked if I could see any common ground between the two sides. I thought it was real doubtful. We're both real angry. But in listening to the testimony again and reading through it again, I think there is a glimmer of hope. Most of the concerns that are brought up about the toxicity of fluoride water additives relate to sodium fluorosilicate or sodium fluorosilicic acid. A third fluoride product is sodium fluoride. Calcium fluoride is mined in China and Mexico. It is sent to Germany where it is converted into hydrogen fluoride gas. The gas is then sent to Solvay, a company in Missouri, where they combine it with sodium to produce sodium fluoride. This is used both in toothpaste and as a water additive. When I called them, they said the difference between the two is that the sodium fluoride has to be ground up finer in order for it to go in toothpaste. They don't have the grinder, so they send it to a company in Arkansas that just grinds it, and then it goes to the toothpaste. Unlike most states, over 40% of Oregon's population who receive fluoridated water, they get sodium fluoride. Both Beaverton, that just passed an ordinance last year that we were involved in, and the Tualatin Valley Water District use it for these practical reasons. Number one, the augers used with sodium fluorosilicate have a lot of moving parts, so they have to be carefully maintained. The saturators used with sodium fluoride require much less maintenance, so labor costs are reduced. Number two, the pH isn't altered using sodium fluoride, so soda ash doesn't have to be added. This also saves money. The labor costs are reduced because occupational safety costs are reduced using the sodium fluoride. So even though the sodium fluoride product costs more than fluorosilicates, they feel that it was made up for by these considerations. At Tualatin Valley Water District, the cost per person per year for sodium fluoride is 38 cents. One reason I have hope that this can depolarize the fluoridation debate is because of an email I received from Dr. Roger Masters last week. He's the one who wrote the study that was often referred to last week by the anti-fluoridationists. His study blames the leaching of lead from old pipes on silica fluorides. However, in his email he wrote, quote, "I'm not opposed to water fluoridation with sodium fluoride and personally use sodium fluoride dental gel and toothpaste." That means he believes that fluoride works to prevent tooth decay and that sodium fluoride is a safe water additive. I believe that too. I would like to make one more statement, and this is concerning the local rights issue. This is a quote from my Oregon Senator, Charlie Starr, regarding water fluoridation. This is a man who is from naturally fluoridated Texas, who got his first cavity when he was 60 years old. Quote, "Some issues transcend the local control problem. The Constitution supports local control, but when the issue goes beyond local jurisdiction, then the state has a legitimate obligation and responsibility to intervene." Thank you. Oh, by the way, if you want to see what calcium fluoride comes out of the ground, it looks like this. It's a little crystal. The amount of fluoride that goes in, this is a gram, half of this is the fluoride. This is the amount that goes in 200 gallons of water, just so you have some visual on that. Any questions?
Thank you, Representative Cromwell. No? Not at this point?
I actually have a question. You said Tualatin Valley already fluoridates the water?
Yes. They're a system of 170,000. They have in the past used sodium fluorosilicate, but because of the problems with the augers, they've just gone, now they're 100% sodium fluoridate, use sodium fluoride. And then Washington County, right?
We had talked... further comment or question to the committee. We had talked about having somebody up here who could address the issue of, there was a concern about
when water was treated about how it was taken out at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And so
the water treatment plants don't know that. And actually, I talked to Clean Water Services mm-hmm. today, and they have a whole list of things that they have to control for. In fact, I could probably have you talk to this man because it's a source control person from Clean Water Services. They handle, like, the Tualatin Valley Water District. The water district doesn't do anything with what's left over. And the Clean Water Services do. And they say they have a list of things that they have to monitor in their effluent, and they said fluoride isn't even on it.
Okay, thank you.
I'll do say one thing, is that if you have a company like Intel that works with computer chips, they are responsible, because they use hydrogen fluoride as a gas to etch glass, is that they may have some fluoride in their effluents, and they're supposed to be cleaning it up themselves.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Lover, are you saying then that companies like Intel have like a pre-treatment plant that they utilize before they send effluent on to the wastewater treatment
I'm
plant?
I'm not exactly sure. That's just what they said, that companies are supposed to treat their own effluent if there's a certain list of things that have to be taken out, and they're supposed to do that. I'm not the right person to be speaking to that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And please, Lois. And we give our first two folks making the discussion a little latitude, because they were here last week and waited all through. But we would ask everybody else you were here too?
Yeah. I waited all the way through, and I put my daughter in daycare for 2 days.
I
also appreciate
that. Okay. And we, staff will come back in a minute and see Tucky. Giving a little latitude on time because of the fact that you were here, some of the folks did talk a little longer last time, but we would generally ask people to try to confine your comments to no more than 5 minutes. And if you have written testimony, we would generally ask you to not read written testimony, but to just kind of paraphrase it for us, because your written testimony, once you've submitted it to us, becomes a part of the record. I don't want to inhibit anything you know that we have to say, but it's simply a matter of economics of time, so that we can try to make sure we get through and hear everyone. And I'm sorry with that. Please proceed, Lois.
Thank you. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Lois Barron. I live in Portland, and I'm an attorney. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1976. I'm pleased to be here today to speak in opposition to HB 2025. Is there an echo? Sounds like, okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
I would like to specifically address the issue of toxins from industrial fluoride, which is the source of additives used in our nation's drinking water. I also want to emphasize that my entire testimony is about the internal use of fluoride, not the topical use. I believe that you have copies of my testimony in front of you, and I have 9 exhibits attached to that. I would like to refer to those exhibits, and I have 4 of those exhibits enlarged. First of all, I'd like to address the question of what has our government been telling us about the safety of fluoride additives in our drinking water, specifically what has the EPA been saying. And as an example, I have a letter dated 1983 from the EPA, and in that letter they state that the information available to the EPA is that fluoridation is safe and effective as a means for reducing the occurrence of dental caries. They go on to endorse or to state that various presidents and surgeons general have endorsed the use of fluoridation, and that water treatment chemicals, including flocyllic acid, have been evaluated for their potential for contributing to the contamination of drinking water. But in more recent times, this is not what the EPA is saying. The truth about the lack of scientific evidence is gradually surfacing. The next exhibit I have is a letter dated 2000 from the EPA to a research professor at Dartmouth College. And in response to the professor's question, the EPA states, to answer your first question on whether we have in our possession empirical scientific data on the effects of flocyllic acid or sodium silico fluoride on health and behavior, our answer is no. We have contacted our colleagues at the research laboratory, and they report that with the exception of some acute toxicity data, they were unable to find any information on the effects of the silico fluorides on health and behavior. This is Exhibit 2 to your packet. Now, even more recently, the EPA acknowledges that it doesn't know how the most widely used fluoridation chemicals interact with other species in the water. As Exhibit 3 in your packet, there's a request for assistance from the EPA dated April of 2002. And in that they acknowledge, and this is a quote, the release of fluoride proceeds through a complex, multi-step equilibrium process that is not well understood. And they go on to talk about the debates and disagreements and complexities concerning this issue. And they're hoping that the data that this brings in will help in understanding the fate of fluoride, including its interactions with other species in drinking water. Now, the next question is, who is regulating additives to our drinking water? And we assume that it's the EPA, but in fact, the EPA does not regulate additives to our drinking water. As indicated in Exhibit 4, which is an EPA letter dated 1998, and this is begin quote, in the United States, there are no federal safety standards which are applicable to drinking water additives, including those intended for use in fluoridating water. So who is it that sets the standards, including the standard 60 that we have heard about? It is established by a non-governmental entity, the NSF International. And these standards are voluntary. Next question, who sits on the committee that sets the NSF standards? Among those are Cargill Fertilizer and Lucier Chemical Industries. Please see Exhibit 5 in your packet. What do Cargill Fertilizer and Lucier Chemical have to do with fluoridation? Well, Cargill Fertilizer is a major producer of the industrial fluoride, which is a waste product of the phosphate fertilizer manufacturing process. And Lucier Chemical, also known as LCI Limited, is a distributor for Cargill's product. Why would Cargill and Lucier be interested in setting water additive standards? See your Exhibit 6 in the packet, which is an EPA letter dated 1978. Begin, quote, chemicals used in water treatment are all industrial-grade chemicals, end quote. The fox is guarding the hen house. Does industrial-grade fluoride contain known toxins? Exhibit 7 in your packet, which is the same as what I have in the enlargement, is a specification sheet from Cargill's distributor, LCI Limited, dated October 1990. And as you see at the top, for reference only, do not send out. And at the bottom, for reference only, do not send out. It lists arsenic, lead, cadmium, mercury, and other contaminants. Next question, Is this an exception, or does all industrial fluoride contain toxins? Your next exhibit is 8.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Surely.
Thank you.
I'm Jay Chocolate.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Barron, can you tell me where these other chemicals and minerals, as far as their numbers on here, where they land on the what's acceptable amounts per million, parts per million on the EPA standards list?
Well, you see, the EPA does not set the standards for additives.
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking you, cadmium, for example, it's 4 zeros and a 3 part per million, I believe. Where's that in relation to what is an acceptable amount of, and, you know, in the best of worlds, I guess we'd have zero, but where is that in relation to an acceptable amount of cadmium, parts per million, in our drinking water, according to EPA standards?
Okay. I thank you for your question. And it's difficult for me to answer that question because the EPA's standards don't relate to additives to drinking water. And there are others here who could testify, I'm sure, to answer your question specifically on what is allowable naturally in the drinking water.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much. I've been hearing testimony for, three days that we've been hearing the fluoride issue with statements about this preparation of fluoride for water systems being the industrial waste of the fertilizer industry. And I guess something that I just wanted to ask was, you know, people have made that statement time and time again, and we've sort of taken it as perhaps fact. Because, you know, nobody's disputed that or anything like that. I'd just like to know if there's some kind of definition of what the industrial, what this waste is, or if there's some kind of, you know, accepted usage, or how people can make that statement and that be. And maybe it's true, but I'd just like to hear why it's true. So, it's not necessarily for this witness as opposed to for the general.
That's a good question, Representative.
Maybe somebody thinks that it isn't the industrial waste of the fertilizer industry, so whatever.
Mr. Chair, on this
topic,
thank you. Mr. Chair, on this topic, I think it would be useful for us, and it may be that one or both of the two witnesses at the table now can deal with this question. I note in the Exhibit 6 from the person who's testifying now that there are three different descriptions of the grade of chemicals. One is industrial grade, which is the one that the witness says she's opposed to using. One is food grade, and one is water treatment. Water treatment grade fluoride compounds. I don't know whether these are three different grades or not. I think we got some hints from the good doctor who testified first that there are different ways of manufacturing these things. And the reason I'm raising this is because it occurs to me that one of the things the committee may want to consider is rather than having a bill that simply has a blanket requirement that fluoride be added to the water, we might want to say something about the grade of the compound that is used. If, for example, the concern is over the trace amounts of other compounds or other minerals such as arsenic and lead and things of that sort, and those are found only in industrial grade fluorides, then the solution to and there hasn't been adequate research on the use of these compounds in the drinking water, as the 78 exhibit says, then the solution may very well be to restrict the chemical grade of the compound which is used to fluoridate the water in Oregon or in the areas that aren't yet fluoridated. I mean, that's one possibility that occurs to me as an issue. We've heard so much about these trace elements, the way of solving that might very well be to take that off the table by restriction of the amounts. My concern is that we don't want to be experimenting with Oregonians' health around the trace elements in these in industrial grade compounds. On the other hand, if we can accomplish the goal of reducing dental caries through using purer compounds that don't contain these other chemicals, that might be something that we want to pursue.
Thank you, Representative. I think that would be a topic and an issue that when we get to work session we will take up, and I believe we're not.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason I raise it now is because I'd like to get some information about
the chair is aware of their, and having heard your concern, it'd be some of the things that, you know, we would be addressing at the future time. Representative Dingfelder.
Mr. Chair, the other piece of information I think would be really helpful that we have during work session, and I don't think we have it, Sandy, unless I'm mistaken, but the American Water Works Association, which sets the standards and the policies for application of fluoride, who, if you know, one of the handouts here shows all the members that are on their committee, the personnel that make those recommendations, I think it would be helpful for us to look at the policy and procedures and see what they recommend. And I would also second what my good colleague from Eugene, Representative Barnhart, mentioned. I think that would be really something that we should explore, because we're hearing again and again concerns about the type of fluoride that's being used. That seems to be one of the major concerns that we're hearing raised. So I think having that information at work session would be really helpful.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, please proceed.
My next question on follow-up to the LCI specifications list was to point out that it's not just LCI specification list that includes information on toxins. In 2000, in response to a subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives, NSF responded with information about the fluoride product that was used, and your Exhibit 8 refers to that. It includes two pages, and the enlargement here includes the first part of that page and a later page showing that, in fact, yes, there's arsenic, lead, mercury, cadmium, and other contaminants. I included only two pages of that NSF letter in the exhibits, but I'd be happy to provide the entire response if the committee would like to see that, and that may be beneficial in answering some further questions that you have. To take it to the next step, next question, why does the fertilizer industry want to sell their fluoride to cities? It is in their hands a hazardous waste, and they could not dispose of it by directly into the air, the water, or the ground, but they are able to sell that same product to the cities for fluoridation purposes.
Mr. Chair?
Jane Dalton.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something for no apparent reason to the record, and that is, I do work for a law firm. My business, I contract out services to some attorneys, and I remember this. One case we were working on. It was a case about wine, the production of wine, a vineyard that was producing wine and reselling the wine that they produced to another winery that would take that and blend it with their wine. They didn't have enough of a specific variety so that they would be able to bottle it and do business. And there was a legal dispute about some of the sale of some of the wine. And while they were going back and forth about the wine spoiled in some way. That it wasn't being properly cared for, another aspect of this litigation, as you can imagine. But I remember the issue about disposing of the wine. And I've been searching my brain for the past few weeks about examples of hazardous waste that we categorize as hazardous waste, and what other things might be that you and I would think of as pretty benign, but that become hazardous waste. And you know what? The wine was hazardous waste. They couldn't dump the wine in the drain, 10,000, 20,000 gallons of the wine in the drain to make it go away, because they're getting to the waterways and adversely impact the waterways. Anyway, it just seemed to me, I just realized or remembered this example that as we get this information about what constitutes hazardous waste and what doesn't constitute hazardous waste, you know, hazardous waste is probably a long list that on one side of the spectrum includes, you know, toxic spent uranium fuel from a nuclear reactor. But in the other case, it represents something that you probably drank for dinner last night. So, not you in particular, Mr. Chair, but anybody in this
I'm
room.
I'm thinking. Several of us may have.
Drank with dinner last night. So I just wanted to throw that up. Food for thought. We drink wine. It's toxic waste if you have to dump it. Thank you. I'm
sure the good chair or the good representative from Salem would probably want to retract that statement in light of what I had for dinner last night.
Uh-oh.
With Salem, you know, water.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Not toxic waste.
Mr. Chair, I do not want to minimize the importance of this topic, no matter where you're at on it, but if they're ever going to dump any beer.
Let's try to get back on task. And I'm sorry, Representative, excuse us for a moment of levity.
Appreciate the levity. To finish my testimony, in view of what we know about the toxins in industrial grade fluoride, with that fact alone, I have to ask the question whether we're saving our children's teeth or whether we're poisoning their bodies. And safety should always come first in making decisions about our children's health. And until the toxins are removed from industrial fluoride and until we have the studies, the facts, not the anecdotes, to prove that fluoride in any form is safe and effective taken internally, we must act wisely and cautiously. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I have just one quick question. You've aimed all of your testimony at the industrial grade fluoridation. To what extent does your position change or your concern change if we were talking about food grade or water treatment grade fluoride compounds instead of industrial grade? I'm just going from the category set up in your own exhibits.
Right, and I wanted to emphasize the toxicity because that seems to be the most glaring problem to me. But there are not the studies, the facts to show that fluoride in the water taken internally is safe and effective. And so for internal purposes to fluoridate water, my position would be that even food grade or pharmaceutical grade should not be used either. We don't have the studies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Shelton.
And ma'am, one more question, please. And this is for anybody in the crowd that if the witness doesn't know the answer. Do you know, and I don't know the answer to this question, if the chlorine we add to the water, is that considered industrial grade chlorine, or is there a different grade of chlorine out there too?
I cannot answer that question. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have another question for Ms. Barron. Have you done any work then in the past to since your testimony is suggesting that this committee not consider the additional fluoridation that's contained within this mandate in this bill because there aren't any studies to show that fluoride is safe and effective, have you then worked in the past to remove fluoridation from existing fluoridation from the communities in Oregon that do have the existing fluoridation of their water streams, and have you done so arguing that what they're doing is not safe and effective, but in fact poisoning? Has that argument resonated? Have you been successful here in Oregon in getting a local community to stop fluoridating that water after they have been fluoridating their water? And could you then also point to examples, since you belong to a Oregon organization as part of a national organization, any successful examples of the national organization stopping fluoride in a water system that's already there?
I'll speak from a personal point of view because I'm a latecomer to this issue. I used to believe in what the government said about fluoridation and its benefits, and I used to believe what the dentist said about fluoridation and its benefits. And it was only a year and a half ago when a trusted healthcare professional talked with me about the issue. And I thought some of the things that she said were rather absurd, so I decided to do my own research. And at that point, I became involved in the issue and saw the dangers of fluoridation. And as you see in my written testimony, I'm now on the board of directors of Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. Lynn Campbell or Jeff Green, who are here, could testify to your question. I'm too much a latecomer to this issue. In fact, this is the very first time I've testified on the issue before anybody. But thank you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But as a member of the board of directors of this group, surely you've heard if there were efforts to remove fluoridation in Oregon's water systems that have fluoridation.
Yes.
Have that history.
Well, we've made efforts with respect to the Beaverton issue. Certainly, that's been the most important one. And of course, Lynn can talk much more knowledgeable on the issue of legislation that we've attempted to introduce on the issue of looking at the safety and efficacy of the product. Yes.
One last question, Mr. Chair. And so, what happened in Beaverton, to your knowledge?
Well, Beaverton went ahead with fluoridation.
So you haven't.
We were not successful.
You were not. Okay.
No.
That's all I have. I just wanted to hear from Ms. Berner. Thank you.
Thank you. At this point, we're going to have Claire Darling and Jeff Green, please, who were here last week. And Ms. Darling, please.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen, members of the committee. I'm very glad to be here today, and I was glad to hear the testimony last week as well. I'll be as brief as I possibly can.
Thank you.
I have testimony from four people today. I'm going to sum them all up. I picked this letter up from a hovel in Northeast Portland last night from a woman who is severely allergic to fluoride. She has severe liver disease. She can't get Social Security because she needs a liver biopsy, but her doctor says, your liver is so far gone, we can't afford a biopsy in good conscience. So she is in some dire straits, and if she were forced to purchase bottled distilled water in order to avoid fluoride because she's severely allergic to it, it puts her in even more dire straits. And she's not the only one allergic. A friend who was here with me last week is also allergic. She can feel it when she drinks it, and her skin cracks, and things happen in her throat, and I don't know all the details. But I think it's important to recognize that I'm not allergic to fluoride, but we need to protect individual biologies from the tyranny of our best intentions, whether we believe in fluoride or not. And then my testimony, I'm going to really skip over. I want to give you a quote from UNICEF. I think they're fairly well respected for caring about children's welfare worldwide. So the worldwide scientific community perspective currently is that scientists are debating whether fluoride confers any benefit at all. And that debate needs to be looked at with some care, I think, so that we can not be left out of the worldwide scientific community. Also, assessing total fluoride exposure, I went and got Fred Meyer milk tested because Fred Meyer's local and close to me, so I got it tested for fluoride before Beaverton wanted to add it. And it was at 0.8 parts per million, which you can probably figure out is very close to one part per million that we're considering adding to the drinking water. So you may have already before you, but I've recopied using sources such as the Journal of the American Dental Association, the Journal of Clinical Pediatric Dentistry, and others. They have lots of foods and waters that have already been tested, foods, waters, juices, processed foods, cereals, etc. if a kid were to drink, or an adult, a glass of milk, a glass of grape juice, and a bowl of cereal for breakfast, they would have more than double the target goal. They would have more, they would have consumed more than 2 milligrams of fluoride.
Mr. Chair, may I? Briefly. Thank you. Your friend that is allergic.
Yeah.
And I understand the financial burden that may be put on them if they had to go buy a bottle of water. Do they have to go buy special milk, special juice, special all that too, because of the reasons?
Yes, for cooking water, like she can't make pasta in fluoridated water. She mentioned also that she can't bathe in it. I know there was some lady in Beaverton. So, to answer your question, she has to be very careful. She can't just go to any restaurant. She can't just buy normal food at the normal grocery store. She's incredibly careful with all of her. She showers the whole thing.
Thank you very much.
So, asking you to perform due diligence and just check how much Oregonians are already consuming, I would suggest they're already over the target goal dose, and I really want you to look at that, please. And thank you for your question, Representative Schaffler. Sorry about that. Okay, how quick am I being? I very briefly want to pinpoint something that Dr. Love had mentioned, that they tested the water, and there was what had been in a fluoridated house just this morning, and that there was no lead or arsenic. I had a similar situation when I tested the lead in the house that we were thinking about getting, and the lab said, nope, there's none. And I took the lab test home and looked at it, and there actually were 10 parts per billion. Well, that is kind of none, but 10 parts per billion is the EPA action level. So is it of concern to me? Yes. Did the lab say it was zero? Yes. We have to be really careful what questions we ask of scientists, because they just tell us the answer that they can give us. Okay. I think this will address fairly specifically the question that Representative Schaffler had asked earlier.
About beer?
Yeah. My name is Claire Darling. I will be reading excerpts from the testimony of Mary Ann Ahman, registered geologist with the state of Oregon, regarding opposition to House Bill 2025. So now I'm speaking in her voice. I am an Oregon State registered geologist and have practiced environmental chemistry and contaminant hydrogeology for over 12 years. I've performed numerous investigations on mines, ore processing, and mining waste. My work involves evaluation of toxicity exposures and calculating risk assessments on human health from exposure to metals and other contaminants. Now, most of this is about hydrofluorosilicic acid and the sodium fluorosilicates, which I understand you're already considering that you might not want to use those. I urge you to read all of her testimony. I'm just going to read a little bit about the phosphate extraction. She was investigating contamination at a phosphoric acid plant, which happened to be a Superfund site. I will simplify the process in order to share with you some pertinent facts. Phosphate rock is cooked to release phosphate. This cooking also releases other elements previously bound up in the rock, such as fluorine, arsenic, lead, mercury, cadmium, you know all those. For many years, phosphoric acid plants released these high concentrations of these heavy metals into the air, contaminating the surrounding landscape, including groundwater. Vegetation died, countrysides turned into barren wastelands, groundwater was left undrinkable, and people began to get cancers, lymphoma, and other debilitating diseases. Eventually, environmental regulations demanded the drastic reductions in the release of these volatile and toxic fluorine compounds. The scrubbers were installed, and these scrubbers need periodic cleaning. Okay, so I'm going to skip about all the heavy metals, and that it's not a pharmaceutical-grade product. Fluorine itself is not a harmless substance. Rather, it is a toxic chemical which is considered a poison. Because of its known toxicity, fluoride has a secondary drinking water standard of 2 milligrams per liter, which transfers into 2 parts per million. Fluoridation proponents would like us to add 1 milligram per liter to our water. As someone who performs risk assessments on human health, I do not consider this to be an adequate margin of safety. Skipping down to the bottom, although proponents of fluoridation would like to say the concentration of the heavy metals found in the waste product would be diluted to such low levels as to be of no concern, I ask why we would even consider adding known toxic chemicals and carcinogens at any concentration. To mandate the addition of a known poison along with impurities for ingestion by all citizens throughout the state is not only ludicrous, it is immoral, and in my mind, criminal. This bill would not benefit the citizens of Oregon, and as elected officials, you are ethically responsible for the protection of the health of all the people in our great state. Please don't contaminate our beautiful water with their hazardous waste. And I paraphrased a great deal there to save time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Green, I think.
Okay, no questions for her? Is that accurate?
Pardon me?
No questions for her at this point?
Don't think there was.
Thank you very much, Chairman Jensen, for allowing me to be able to speak with you and the committee. My name is Jeff Green. For the record, I'm the National Director for Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. I've been a management consultant for dentists since 1971. I specialized on teaching dentists how to be able to incorporate patient home hygiene care and also monitoring systems so people could stay on top of their health. I didn't become involved with this issue until 1996. I am not anti-fluoride. I think the fluorine and fluoride are some of the most valuable compounds that we can possibly use. I don't think you should be drinking them. I don't think you should be putting them in your body. And I have lots of evidence to indicate why. However, a primary reason for me being able to be here today is to try to hopefully clarify some things for you that may not have been said by some of your previous testimony. First thing is about the nature of fluoride. Fluorine is the element, and many of you may already recognize that fluorine is part of the halogen group. And most of us recognize the rest of the halogen group except for one. Bromine, iodine, chlorine, and another one, astatine, which most people are not aware of. Fluorine, the element itself, is the most negatively charged element in the world. And I need to re-accentuate that, the most negatively charged element in the whole world. It's the bully of the periodic chart. It can do whatever it wants to do. For those people who talk in the vernacular, it's promiscuous, which means it will give up whatever it's with to be with something else if it likes it better. What it likes a lot is calcium. What it likes a lot is magnesium and a lot of the other positive aspects of the elements that we have out there. So what you find is that it certainly does seek what we call calcium. In most cases, those people who project that fluoride would be good for you is that if that some aspect of the fluoride element would actually be attracted to the teeth so that it can actually help mineralize and create a stronger tooth surface so that it would be resistant to acid dissolution. Okay. Unfortunately, that's not all that fluoride is and all that fluorine is, and it's really important to put this into perspective. And so much of this topic is almost as if somehow or other this is something that was found in the ground, and its only real use is to put it in water somehow or other, and that it's supposed to fix teeth when in fact it's used for a variety of things. First of all, it's prized by industry, by commercial, by pharmaceutical businesses, by the military. And the reason why it's prized is because it has 4 major components, major ways of acting that should play importance in your decision making. The first one being is that it disrupts molecular bonds. That because of its nature and because of its ability and its affinity to other elements, it's able to disrupt other molecular bonds and create a difference between something that's happening. And so part of the reason for that, and one of the reasons why industry loves it, is because it's used to what you call refine almost virtually every heavy metal. Another thing it does is it's able to establish molecular bonds, meaning to solidify other bonding aspects so that there's a more stable bond that's created as well. And in addition to that, it's an enzyme inhibitor. It inhibits at least 150 enzymes that we know, and probably literally thousands, but at least 150 enzymes we know that it inhibits. An example of some of the things it inhibits and has enzymes is thyroxine production, which has to do with the thyroid, insulin production, which obviously would have to do with diabetes, serotonin production, which would have to do with a number of different things, but basically serotonin is the chemical transmitter between brain neuron to brain neuron, and so it can interfere with that, melatonin production. So why does this become important? There are products all around you that are fluoride. as long as you continue to use the word fluoride as everybody's talking about the same thing, to me it's a little silly because it doesn't have anything to do with that at all. Prozac is a fluoride product. It's called fluoxetine. Rohypnol, they call the date rape drug, is a fluoride product. The fenfen, the fenfluramine, was a fluoride product that was pulled off the market. Bacol was pulled off the market for muscle degeneration, was a fluoride product. Sarin gas that you hear about over in the Gulf War and so forth is a fluoride product. Certain things that have also been pulled off and are being pulled off right this minute are fluoride products as well. Some of your, especially Scotchgard, most people don't realize that Scotchgard is being pulled off the market because the fluoride product is what it is. They didn't believe that they thought that the molecule was too large to be integrated into the body, and what it turned out was is it wasn't, and they're finding it in people's blood all over the world. Teflon is a fluoride product. So the first part of it is to realize that when someone says, hey, it's just this mineral over here, that isn't true, and there's an awful lot of regulations to deal with fluoride products. They have to do with whether somebody can ingest them and what those dosages are. So, what I would suggest to you is that there are certain things that when we start talking about this issue, that for some reason we kind of get way off on a tangent, we don't ask the most basic of questions. And so I'd ask if you're actually looking at in my testimony that you look at the second page for an area that's highlighted, or excuse me, at least bolded. It says, here are the fluoride questions in which I suggest you should be judged for your due diligence. What I would suggest to you is that if I came to you and said that we should be putting aloe vera in the water, and try to convince you that it was good for the digestive system, which I happen to believe that it is, and also I'm able to show you that if I get a paper cut on my finger, that I can actually make the paper cut with aloe vera actually heal much faster. This may be something that most of you would probably kick me out of here for, but if we did start to talk about it, there would be questions that you would ask, and you wouldn't skip over to, did a trade organization endorse this or not? You want to look at what I would call due diligence kind of questions. And I suggest to you that there's four of them that if you answer these questions, you'll say no to fluoridation, and you will not be able to say yes to adding these substances to the water. The first one is, out of all the paperwork that you've received, before you make it a law that everyone has to ingest more, which study identifies how much fluoride people in Oregon are already receiving from all sources already? Before you ever put it in the water, how much fluoride are people already receiving before you add it to the water? Now, to me, it's ludicrous to think that somebody's going to say, we're going to put a concentration in the water in which you can't control dosage because you can't control how much water someone's going to receive, and that you have not evaluated, and that you would accept a promoter coming in here and say, I want to mass medicate through the water system now, and I want you to do this without ever considering how much is everybody getting already. As of 1996, Safe Drinking Water Act says that you no longer can just talk about what's in the water, that you have to look at all media. You determine whether how much fluoride people are receiving from all sources as opposed to just what's in the water. A real clue to you would be is that someone starts talking to you about a concentration, which is one part per million, what does that have to do with dosage? We all know that if it's going to be a benefit or if it's going to be of harm, that we would be talking, if we were talking from a doctor's sense, we'd be talking about dosage somehow. Second question, which study have you reviewed that identifies any subset of the population that does not have ready access to at least 1 milligram of fluoride per day without it appearing in the water? And if so, who are these people? It's in cereals, it's in fruit juices, it's in sodas, it's on produce as a pesticide level, and unless you're eating organic, you can't get away from it at this particular point. It's all over. But my saying that shouldn't have to be any part of this equation. That if you had a promoter coming to you and telling you to convert your water system and compel every citizen in these communities to drink this, I would think that you have a responsibility to due diligence to find out, again, one, first of all, how much are they getting? Two, what people are not getting enough? Because that isn't what the statistics show from government documents right now. If you're in a non-fluoridated community, you're already getting 1 milligram, and if you're in a fluoridated community, you're getting way above the level that everybody said that they wanted to receive, and we already have more dental fluorosis. The third thing is, before you commit yourself to the front end of what I call an inevitable bait and switch, and I call it a bait and switch for a reason, and you're touching upon it for this reason here. The decision that you make to decide that you're going to fluoridate the water means that somewhere down the line, someone else has to decide what they're going to fluoridate with. And what we've seen is that they're not using what most of the individuals, at least, within your community would suspect. They would think it's the same quality as found in their toothpaste, and they would think it must be okay because you said so. However, when we go to the bait and switch and we now find out that it's a substance that's never been studied before, I'm in shock as to how people move through that. How do you get past the question that if you got a 60-year controversy, whether you want to call it a controversy or not, at least the fight's been going on that long. He had 60 years of this particular state not forcing people to put it down their, stick it down their throat. And what would possibly compel you to say, I've seen enough evidence about the actual substance that's going to be used in here that makes me say, I think that's safe and I think that that's effective. So what I would suggest to you is that there are a couple of things that stand out from this as to how this is being sold to you. One of them, and one of the documents that you see right here in the, in, that you've already seen already, is a SMILE survey of 2002. So instead of you looking at a study at the actual hydrofluosilicic acid that's used in most of the systems, instead what we have is we have a study here that says we need to fluoridate. Now, the study really didn't evaluate all of the factors that had to do with whether you have low tooth decay or high tooth decay. In fact, I believe that you had the person who testified said it straight out in her testimony that it didn't indicate any of those factors at all. But you can see if you go to the pages that we've highlighted right here, that in the introduction it says, for SMILE Survey 2002, we've conducted a visual screening of the teeth of 3,900 Oregon elementary school children representing all 36 counties. Now, this is being represented to you as people who are selling. Yes.
Could we move along? I mean, you've given us the written testimony. You've highlighted it for us.
Okay. I'd like to at least finish this part here that on this portion, please. And I'd be happy to move along.
Thank you.
However, the results says very clearly of the 86 schools originally selected, 70 agreed to participate. At what point do you accept this as a reliable document when on one part it says we did it with 36 counties and the back part you said it and did it in 22 counties? So what I would suggest is that there's a lot of things that you need to take a look at. A couple of things that I would like to answer that came up as questions earlier. One of them has to do with the concentrations of contaminants. If you dilute the product and put it into the water that someone is going to drink, in many cases you will come up with what we would call a non-detect, meaning that you will not be able to detect how much arsenic is in the water. That's pretty amazing. Why not? Because measuring devices don't go that low. However, at what point does arsenic begin to harm someone? Does it start at the detect level or does it start way, way, way lower than that? And if you follow what the maximum contaminant level goal that was created by the EPA, which was a scientific point of safety, what they've said is that there is no point of safety for arsenic in the water. Now, in the state that I'm come from, in California, they don't believe in the creating zeros. Instead, what they do is they have to come up with a number that's measurable. So in March of 2004, they actually came out with a number that said, what is the danger level for arsenic in the water? And their conclusion was, which is the most recent one that's been established, by the way, in any of the states, was that 4 parts per trillion caused one person in a million to have either bladder cancer or lung cancer. Now, the importance of one of the documents that you saw up here that had to do with the levels of arsenic that NSF established was in some of these samples that they saw was one they showed an average of 0.43 parts per billion, and another one was 1.66. This is after dilution. Now, the truth is they do have a way to be able to evaluate that. It's just that every water district doesn't have it. But when they compute this by being able to actually evaluate how much is actually in the raw product before they figure out how they're going to dilute it down, that 1.66 represents approximately one person in every 1,000 having lung cancer or bladder cancer during their lifetime. This is what the big fight for arsenic was over these years, these last 50 years of trying to bring the number down, is that there isn't any doubt that it causes lung cancers and bladder cancers. So the first thought that I would tell you is that the idea of no detection doesn't mean that there's not harm that occurs. Second part is that the MCL, some people talk about the standard MCL. The MCL was created for source water, in which it's a remediation point that says you've got to stop delivering it at that point. It doesn't say it's good water, and it is not an invitation for you to fill her up, to come to some point level that says I can put as much lead in there as I want to, and these in there as long as they come up to those levels, and that's why they're not utilized for water additives. I'd like to add one aspect to having to do with the legal aspect of it, because ultimately, at some point, someone's going to ask that there's someone be accountable for the action of putting something in the water. Now, whether that comes in an earlier stage politically, or we're finally...
Break the kind of committee thing here and ask a question. At some point, someone may ask why we don't put something in water, too, when we have tooth decay and other diseases, other illnesses, and problems that go with it. So I appreciate, you know, your comments. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate what you've given us.
we're in dire need of moving along because we have many other people who are wanting to testify. So,
if I could address the one aspect of legal, because it seemed to be a question, if you wouldn't mind.
I think you probably covered your point, and to go further would probably be counterproductive.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the gentleman could finish his comments in writing and get them to us, and we'll be able to take a look at them through that.
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Thank you. Please summarize, if you have. Want to make a summary statement.
My summary statement is that that the Supreme Court has made a decision that adding something to the water without having it approved by the FDA and compelling someone to drink something that hasn't been approved by the FDA is an arbitrary action that governments cannot do, and it just recently happened in 2003. So I would ask the question, who amongst you is going to raise your hand and say yes to adding something to the water that has never been approved? Second of all, that is not batch tested to assure what the content is. And three, admittedly, in every court situation that's happening currently right now, contains lead and arsenic. And I thank you for your time.
Okay. Is the citation to the case you just referred to in your materials?
Yes. In fact, there's several citations. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Teresa Cordova. And Teresa's been with us since 8 o'clock this morning.
9:15. Thank you, Sandy. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Cordova. I live in Westland, Oregon. I'm a stay-at-home mom to two young grade schoolers. I left my written testimony at Kinko's, so I'm glad that you said that about paraphrasing. I'm originally from Washington, D.C., and there 100% of the public water supply is fluoridated. So our congresspeople have been drinking fluoridated water for many, many years now, probably gratefully so.
That's the problem, huh?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Sorry,
not at all. I grew up and spent 25 years of my life there, and I didn't have cavities. My friends didn't have cavities. We had maybe some among us had one, but that would be it. And I remember eating toothpaste as a child, and I remember liking the taste of it. And I never even heard that there was a condition called fluorosis until I moved out here and people were talking about it. So I moved out here. I got married and moved out here, and I was concerned about the fact that there was no fluoride in the water. So I became more diligent. I eat healthily anyway, and I can't remember a day I didn't floss and brushed and floss between every single one of my teeth. But after a while, I did get a cavity, and I was shocked. And so I asked my dentist, what's going on? Is there anything I can do better? And he said, no, not much. He said the water isn't fluoridated, and that's the main problem. And as consolation, because I was very sad, he told me that another one of his patients, an elderly man who moved here from Arizona, where there is a very high natural concentration of fluoride in the water, had developed 5 cavities since he had come out here and was also complaining to him, asking him why he was getting cavities when he hadn't before, and he didn't eat candy and he took good care of his teeth. And I think he asked him, what's going on, John? At any rate, so I decided to get my teeth sealed, and I bought a Sonicare, and I use a fluoride rinse, and I recently developed another cavity. And so I just think in my own experience, it's what I'm doing, it's not working as well as water fluoridation. I never had a problem before, and I loved sugar as much as any other kid did, and I certainly ate my share of it. But now we don't drink juice. We don't have sweets in the house. I don't make dessert for my kids. And I'm just very surprised I'm getting them. I am also a mom, and I have spoken with other moms about this issue in Westland. I've been speaking with them over the years. We all give our kids fluoride tablets, and we all brush their teeth with fluoride. And I'm still surprised at the number of kids I see with cavities in their school. You know, the ones that I see are obviously the amalgam ones. I wouldn't see the other ones that are tooth-colored. But I have been surprised, and it's much more than I remember seeing as I was when I was a young child. I think that was all that I had written down, pretty much. There are some neighbors who do have perfect teeth, and their kids have perfect teeth, but they have well water. They live a few blocks away. They have well water, and it's naturally fluoridated, so they don't receive public water at all. The mom who hasn't gotten cavities since she moved there, and her kids have perfect teeth, she said that they carry their water around them with them everywhere. To school, to work, and she suggested that I do the same. Why don't you get fluoride drops and put it in your water to the one part per million and then carry it around with you everywhere? She said, I know it's a hassle, but it's better than what you got now. So, I thought that was interesting. I do have some more. I'm sorry. Reading material. I just have one copy. This is just a chart of the different states and the number of water supply people who receive water supply systems, public water supply systems that are fluoridated. And I just have one copy of that.
Make a copy of it for everybody on the committee,
okay,
so they all have it.
But I do have. Got a copy of the ADA and the American. Oh, thank you, Sandy.
Okay. And all it is I printed a few pages from the American Dental Association website and the American Academy of Family Physicians website, and they both provide great, extensive information on fluoridation. The American Dental Association has a 56-page booklet. Have you all received that? The 56-page booklet from the American Dental Association on fluoride?
Yes.
You have received that. Okay. And they say on page 2, they say, from time to time, opponents of fluoridation have questioned its safety and effectiveness. None of these charges has ever been substantiated by generally accepted science. It's important to review information about fluoridation with a critical eye. Listed below are several key elements to consider when reviewing information about fluoride research. And then it says, the number one, the author's background and credentials. Number two, the year of publication should be apparent. I noticed that in one of the speakers who spoke with the big letters on the boards, I think her information was 1978 to 1990, if I remember well. And then the American Academy of Family Physicians, I highlighted some stuff on the first page, and I tacked on something to the back of the packet because it referred to the Healthy People 2000 document. I thought you might wonder what the Healthy People document is, so I tack that onto the last page of your packet. It's the brightly colored one. And I have one I didn't make copies for you for because I figured that you probably already have it. Healthy Teeth for a Lifetime, and it's a whole bunch of different organizations and what they say about fluoridation. American Association of Family Physicians, American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Council on Science and Health, American Dietetic Association, Medical Association, Public Health Association, School Health Association, Society for Nutritional Sciences, and then different dental associations around the world, Australian, Canadian, the Head Start Bureau, Mayo Clinic, National Academy of Sciences, Office of the Surgeon General, World Health Organization, and the top, the 10 great public health achievements, United States.
Teresa.
So,
yeah.
I'll pass it off. And thank you. Sorry.
I That's all right, Teresa. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
At this point, we've got a couple of individuals that are saying over 100 miles away. Dr. Denell, is that right? Dino? And we have Dr. Haney. And Nicholas.
Chair Jensen and members of the committee, thank you. I am not only representing myself, but 10 other concerned physicians of the Southern Oregon area who could not cancel their practices to come up today and testify. You have heard a lot of compelling testimony this afternoon. Until 1999, I was in favor of fluoridation. Then asked why, I realized the only reason I was in favor was because I heard it was good. On doing my own due diligence, I recognized, as you well recognize, how controversial and complicated this issue is. The medical literature is very, very difficult to understand. I will try not to reiterate what has been eloquently stated by other people who have testified this afternoon. But as a physician, I would like to make several comments which I think are very important. First of all, the FDA has never approved any fluoride substance for ingestion to prevent dental cavities, only topically applied dental preparations. It is well recognized that the benefit of fluoride is not from systemic ingestion, but topical application. As a physician, I am greatly concerned that government mandating fluoridation to prevent cavities is the government practicing medicine without ever meeting a patient, without ever taking their history, without ever doing a physical exam or knowing their medical problems. That would be considered and is malpractice. It is intolerable should this committee choose to fluoridate water with the fluorosilicates because of the previously mentioned heavy metal toxicities and the known neurotoxicity of lead and cancer toxicity of arsenic. So if the committee chooses to go that route...
Representative Dalto.
Yeah, thank you. Apologize for interrupting your testimony. Out of curiosity, the government, through public health authorities at the county level, provide vaccinations for kids. When they provide vaccinations for kids, I'm just trying to understand your analogy about practicing medicine on a government sort of level. When they vaccinate children, do they do physicals and histories and all that kind of work before they give kids vaccinations? Because I'm not sure.
No, they do not, Representative Dalto. However, infectious disease, communicable diseases, are in a far different state than dental cavities, which are not communicable.
Okay, and that's all I want to know.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And to expound on that, if the government states that they should and know better to treat the general population for medical conditions, why not obesity? Why not hypertension? Why not hypercholesterolemia? All of which are far greater issues to society than dental cavities. We heard very compelling evidence from Dr. Love about difficulties with dental hygiene. I agree with that 100%. And I could tell stories of all the cardiovascular effects, effects of diabetes, effects of hypertension. That does not give this government a license to treat those problems. That's an individual doctor-patient decision. If this committee chooses to fluoridate with the fluorosilicates that we know are contaminated, I have submitted a letter requesting that you impanel a special panel of medical experts with expertise in toxicology to give you information on the potential risk of even minute amounts of heavy metals such as lead and arsenic that Mr. Green alluded to in his testimony. Over the past 30 years that I have practiced medicine, I have been deeply humbled by dogma that we were taught in the medical profession as being beneficial and helpful for medical treatment, and which was embraced by national societies, just as fluoride is by the ADA, and when the appropriate, well-done scientific studies were performed, we were found to be dead wrong. A good case example is that of hormonal replacement therapy in postmenopausal women. 15 years ago, the American Cardiology Association was recommending that women take hormonal replacement therapy with the aim of reducing myocardial infarction and stroke. When the scientific studies were completed, to our astonishment, there was a greater risk for heart attack, stroke, and blood clot to the lung on taking hormonal replacement therapy, and now we recommend against it. I just want to warn you that if we don't open up our vision to look for that which we do not want to see, we may make grave mistakes, and that's particularly true in the healthcare arena.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair, right. Doctor. Please, very briefly, please. Sir, the window of when we, as a society and a medical profession, started prescribing those hormonal medicines, when did they start prescribing it, and how long did it take us to realize that that was the wrong thing to be doing?
That was
some history on that.
Yeah, in the late 40s and 50s, and we stopped in the 90s. There is a long list of substances that were embraced as...
Excuse me, Doctor. I thought you were about wrapped up. Are you about through?
Very shortly.
Thank you.
There are a long list of substances, asbestos, DDT, dioxin, Freon, which we initially thought were not risky, only to learn after widespread contamination that they're very risky. Pregnant women now are advised not to eat tuna because of methylmercury in the tuna, a known toxin. So I urge this committee to use great caution, and I also urge the committee that if you choose to use the fluorosilicates, that you panel a group of experts to advise about the potential risks of the heavy metal contaminants. And I'd like to just take one last moment to reemphasize what Jeff Green has said. Fluoride is a very highly reactive compound. It is not safe. And the levels of fluoride in our consumption have increased dramatically over the past 50 years. Fluoride is used in all kinds of pharmaceuticals because it makes them work better. And it is terribly troubling to me as a physician to know that we have not looked at the potential physiology other than on the teeth for widespread fluoride use. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. So,
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I wonder if staff could pass out my handout and the CD that I prepared. I'm Dr. Chuck Haney, a retired general surgeon and recently retired city councilman from Hood River. I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up in Milton Free Water. I have crummy teeth. I took my undergraduate work in Walla Equipment College. My CV is in your packet. I want to testify on three issues. Firstly, does fluoridation prevent cavities? Secondly, is public water fluoridation a threat to the environment? And lastly, if there's time, I want to speak to the nature and the intensity of local hometown fluoride politics. A 1990 study by Drs. Brunel and Carlos is described accurately by antifluoridations as one of the largest studies ever done. They found that the average difference in cavities between fluoridated and non-fluoridated U.S. cities was only 18% better with fluoridation. Anti-fluoridationists argue that this is too small to be worth the trouble. Many states, such as Kentucky, approach 100% fluoridation. In these areas, a few non-fluoridated towns surrounded by fluoridated towns participate in the benefits. Fluoride is in the peas, the soda pop, the beer, is drunk dining out and visiting friends. This is called the halo effect. Brunel and Carlos's data shows that in regions where fluoridation is a rule rather than exception, there is little difference between fluoridated and unfluoridated towns. This average hides the truth about Oregon. Only 19% of Pacific region citizens drank fluoridated water. In our region, there was a 61% less tooth decay in the fluoridated towns. This is exactly the wonderful results that were found when fluoridation was begun in the 1940s. It is exactly the wonderful result that Dr. John Berry saw in his patients when Corvallis was fluoridated over 40 years ago. Table 9 from the Brunel and Carlos study on page 5 of my handout shows the information that should be important for Oregon decision makers. Pediatric dentist Kyle House in our community recently compared Head Start screening kids in the Dalles, which has been fluoridated since 1956, to Hood River. In the Dalles, approximately three times as many children had no cavities compared to unfluoridated Hood River. Thus, the view from home confirms the Brunel and Carlos data. Please remember 61%, not 18. Anti-fluoridationists believe that fluoridation has never been conclusively studied. In answer, I've included in your packets a CD of summaries from some 170 scientific publications. There are approximately 35,000 publications on fluoride in the National Library of Medicine's database. The database includes rigorous standards for peer review, objectivity, and scientific merit. Generally, you can simply read the conclusions and understand the point of the articles. I am confident that by simply browsing through these files, you can form your own opinion as to whether or not fluoridation has reasonable scientific basis. Now, the environmental debate. The reason that fluoridation poses no environmental threat has to do with dilution. I know most about the fluoridation agent proposed in Hood River, and I will speak to that local situation. Concern has been raised that contaminants in fluoride, chiefly lead and arsenic, will harm the environment. The Tualatin Water District and the Dalles both use the Solvay Chemical Company's sodium fluoride. The laboratory analysis of this product is in your packet. The Solvay website, as discussed earlier, shows three products. One, that intended for metallurgy, paint, glass, and other industrial uses. Two, that which is used as sodium fluoride water additive. And three, medical grade or USP grade. The amount of arsenic in the water additive product exceeds the purity of the U.S. pharmacopoeia standard for medical grade sodium fluoride by a factor of 10. Medical grade is the stuff that's in the kids' tablets in your toothpaste. To make medical grade sodium fluoride, no additional purification of the water additive grade is necessary with respect to either lead nor arsenic. The purity is consequent to the manufacturing process of sodium fluoride from apatite ore. The process is similar to distilling water in that a very pure product results from the nature of the chemistry. 2 milligrams of sodium fluoride is added to each liter of water to achieve optimum dental health benefits. This creates a number. You put a decimal point, write 11 zeros, and then write 2 milligrams of arsenic per liter, or 2 parts per trillion arsenic in the drinking water. Now, how much is this, you might ask? Well, 2 parts per trillion is as 2 minutes is to 19,026 centuries. It is 2 inches as to 634 times around the world at the equator. It is truly very, very little. And again, it is less than the standards for medicine. Other perspectives on the amount of arsenic are that 2 parts per trillion is a concentration 500 times less than is measurable. It is a concentration 5,000 times more pure than the EPA standards for arsenic in drinking water, and is 500 times more pure than the NSF standard 60 discussed earlier. The arsenic in wastewater is further diluted many millionfold when it reaches the river into which it flows. The river concentration of arsenic due to fluoridation is astronomically small. There can simply be no biologic effect whatsoever. The fluoridation component is certainly many factors less than the background natural arsenic concentration. Our anti-fluoridationists have repeatedly argued in the press that the fluoride increases lead through lead leaching. Only agents which change the acidity of the water leach lead. Sodium fluoride has no effect whatsoever of lead leaching from pipes. Because of dilution, there is no risk for the aquatic environment from lead or arsenic in water fluoridated with the Solvay sodium fluoride product. Now, the first page of a 1989 article by Damker and Day, which studied the pollution event at the John Day Dam, is in your packet. Increasing the John Day Dam pool to 0.5 parts per million fluoride required a pollution event of the largest magnitude. The Dalles cherry growers successfully sued the smelter owners for airborne fluoride damages to ruin cherry crops. Miles away and partially protected by westward winds, Hood River's water was found to actually contain optimum fluoride concentration for dental health. Industrial pollution, mega disasters simply have nothing to do with public water fluoridation. Salmon spend most of their lives eating and drinking in seawater that contains 1.2 to 1.5 parts per million. And many streams in Canada and in Oregon and in North America teem with fish at as high as 0.4 parts per million. analyses from Tacoma, the Puyallup Indian Nation, which are determinations of non-significance, and a peer-reviewed professional study from Quebec formally proved no environmental effect from fluoridation. Those are in your packet. Anti-fluoridation has described fluoride and heavy metals accumulating in river mud. Only particulates can settle to the bottom of the river. Sodium fluoride has a very high solubility constant and immediately dissolves when placed in water. It cannot be a particulate. The infinitesimal amounts of lead and arsenic are also completely in solution. So in summary, there's simply too much dilution. First, the fluoride is diluted to one part per million, and further, enormous dilution occurs when the 60% of the fluoride in the water returns to the aquatic environment as wastewater. It just isn't enough to cause a problem. In this matter, you should look to professional fish biologists, not amateur anti-fluoridation eco-activists. Remember that two-thirds of America fluoridates. As with all the anti-fluoridation claims of harm, which range from allergy, bone fractures, metal disease, Down syndrome, cancer, if public water fluoridation were truly a problem, it would be well understood and defined after 60 years. Now, I'm short on time, so I'm just going to summarize the politics.
Thank you.
It's my contention that local politics are dominated by outside interest groups. We have the Columbia River Keepers bringing outside activists going door to door to gain signatures for their measure, which will ban fluoride without mentioning it, by incorrectly labeling sodium fluoride as an industrial waste byproduct. Industrial chemists believe that as soon as you put money into a product stream, it is no longer waste. Just like the lumber industry that makes paper and chipboard out of what used to be burned, the manufacturers of materials from apatite ore are going to extract every ounce of economic value out of that product stream. And it takes a lot of money to heat that product stream and process the sodium fluoride and the fluorosilicates. In addition, the sodium fluoride comes from a stream that's separate from the silico fluorides and actually is a co-product with the calcium phosphate, which is used in chicken feed to harden eggs. And for that matter, it can be manufactured from fluoroapatite in Mexico and China and not be part of the industrial stream that makes phosphate fertilizer at all. The question should simply be, is it clean enough? Is it proper? Does it work? And I think there's plenty of data to show it does.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Appreciate your time and testimony. Thank you both for coming today. And moving right along, we have Nancy Krumpacker. And let me ask a couple of others. Maureen Cherrod. And Devon Bryant. Could you all come up, please?
Maureen went to feed the meter.
Oh, went to feed the meter?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Ship me back.
All right. Please, go ahead, Doctor. Mm-hmm.
Is Celia with Devon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you want to testify, too?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Jensen, and the committee members for this opportunity to present my opposition to this bill. I have copies. I've made my 25 copies, and you can certainly look at that. First of all, I'm not disputing that fluoride prevents dental caries. However, we know now through advances in science that regular use of fluoride toothpaste has a marked effect on dental enamel to prevent caries, and the preventative action of fluoride actually occurs after teeth have erupted through the gum, and therefore topical application is appropriate, not internal ingestion. Everybody's already talked about the contaminants from the fluorosilicates, and nobody's going to dispute the toxicity of lead. However, I think it's important to review that the long-term damage to intelligence was first reported in 1943. And then three recent studies show that IQ declines are greater at levels of less than 10 micrograms per deciliter than at higher concentrations. And the most recent study in 2003 in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that there's absolutely no safe blood lead level. So we don't want to be adding lead to the water through the action of the fluorosilicates. I'll just point out, people have also already talked about arsenic. I'm a retired oncologist, and I'm on the board of directors of Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition. The cancer that hasn't been mentioned that's associated with arsenic is skin cancer. One point I'd like to make, and maybe this was made last week, is that when you consider the expense of fluoridating water, you have to keep in mind that dental fluorosis, the incidence of dental fluorosis over the past 30 years has been steadily increasing. Several studies show that. But in order to treat that is an expensive process, and that should be figured in. And we've already talked about all the multiple sources of fluoride in addition to the fluoride in the water. Another point I would like to make is that in considering the toxicity of any chemical is that there are certain populations that are very susceptible to certain chemicals, and with fluoride, it's those who lack calcium, magnesium, and vitamin C in their diet. So they're going to be more susceptible to fluoride. Excess fluoride can increase the risk of long bone fractures in postmenopausal women with osteoporosis and elderly men who also can develop osteoporosis. In rare instances, excessive amounts of fluoride can produce skeletal fluorosis, which results in crippling bone deformities, spinal compression, and restricted joint movement. Because our knowledge is incomplete regarding the amount, duration, and mode of fluoride exposure that can cause deleterious effects, and because of side effects we've yet to discover, we should keep the amount of exposure to a minimum. We do have an alternative to fluoridating our water with topical application tailored to each individual patient. We should not be making mass treatment decisions for such a complex issue. As a physician who practiced cancer medicine for 22 years, I would never, both ethically and legally, recommend a treatment with surgery, radiation, or drugs without considering the possible benefits, risks, and alternatives for an individual patient. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. Appreciate your coming. Appreciate your being here. Please.
Hi, representatives. My name is Devin Bryant. Thank you for letting me speak. I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist or doctor or anything like that, but I just need to come up and tell you my opinion. First of all, when you were talking about wine, the spoiled wine could be considered a waste product. It's true. We all drink wine. It's true. But would you consider mandating putting wine in drinking water? No. Also, when you go home tonight, look at your toothpaste tubes. You all have toothpaste tubes in your bathroom. Look at the back of it. It says, do not ingest. If you ingest, immediately call a physician. That's talking about the fluoride. The fluoride in it is not to be ingested, and you want to put it in the drinking water. And that will be ingested when people drink water, when people water their gardens. I mean, I know Oregon has a large amount of organic gardeners. Will they now lose their organic status because you put fluoride in their water that they're using their crops? That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your... let's see. Was it Maureen? Yes. Would you please come up? And then after Maureen, we have Patrick Rotz, Dick Campbell, and Tom Mayer, I believe, is... Yeah. Please, Maureen.
Hi, Tom.
Yes.
Thank you very much for just a few minutes, and I will be brief. I'm a basically a lay person, but a mother and a grandmother, Oregonian from the get-go, 43-year-old snob, or whatever you call it. Anyway, I retired from 27 years of work for the government, and in more recent years I've been involved in nutrition and wellness and glyconutrient technology, which is on the forefront of immunity and so forth, and with a research and development company in Texas. But because of these 10 years of working with this company, I've been exposed to a lot of doctors all over the country, from all over the country and the world, discussing what is needed for the body's health and what is not needed for the body's health. And so my talk is just strictly general. They have the statistics. They have the great facts. Mine is, I just think it's a bigger picture, and the toxicity in our whole environment, water and food, and in our meat and our milk is way beyond what it was 40, 50 years ago. It's like they said, it's everywhere. And so from the industrial dumping and from the vaccines that all people get of all ages, it's probably a lot more we need. And they really covered that really well. But another part that's of interest to me, and I've heard other doctors talk about, including Dr. Douglas, and he's been right on a lot of things. Alzheimer's has been a big topic in the last few years, and it's a growing concern for lots of people and lots of families. And if there is a connection between these toxic heavy metals and this aluminum and this fluoride compounds, and that they do go to the brain, and cumulative effects are of all these drugs are a problem, prescription drugs and food additives, they're cumulative. We don't just take them one little bit one day. We take them our whole lifetime. And I think that's where there's a lot of problems come in, for people don't realize that you can't detect it on a just one day use. But on and on and on, they're very dangerous. And as they have said, the FDA does not approve it, and there's no real studies. Another thing I like, and I happen to run across from another doctor, is that most of the European countries do not use it. Scandinavia has said, no, we do not want it. We haven't been doing it. They don't do it. And so for some reason, they have a whole different slant and a whole different perspective on it than we have acquired. And I think that's something to be aware of. So as a lifelong student of nutrition and wellness, and having three grandchildren that are pretty well grown, I think there's a lot more to children's dental health than just fluoride. It's their whole nutrition, their whole mineral intake, a lot of aspects to the nutrition that's beyond what fluoride is. And not to say there isn't some correlation, because apparently there is. So even though I've lived in Salem for over 30 years, I have often thought of moving to a community that does not have it, and I would like to do that. And I don't really want to be faced with not having any community in Oregon, over 10,000 people, where I could go. So I just don't see it as a necessary thing. And even the contaminants in vaccines and so forth, there's a way out for any entity or any government agency that wants to provide them or dictate them. And so every state but two has exceptions for children's vaccines. And if parents are well-read, well-versed, and they have a stand, every state but two has a way for them to state their objection and make it an option for their child. And where this type of thing, there's no option. And I personally learned a lot today about the fluoride that's already in foods that most people eat regularly. I mean, I really didn't have any idea of that. So appreciate the time.
Thank you very much for coming. Doctor? You with the Board of Dentistry?
Yes. Chair Jensen and members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to appear here. For the record, my name is Patrick Bratz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and I want to testify on behalf of the board. The board at their meeting on Friday, January 21st, voted unanimously to support House Bill 2025, and they did so with the following statement. The Oregon Board of Dentistry strongly urges the legislature to support this legislation as the single most important piece of legislation which would protect the public's oral health in the state of Oregon with the least possible cost. The Board of Dentistry shares the concerns that many of the people have testified that Oregon, to be such an innovative and progressive thinking state and yet rank 48th out of 50 states in the level of people having access to fluoride water, simply is not in the public's best interest. I might state as a personal note, I am not an Oregonian. I came here about a year and a half ago. I came from the state of Wisconsin, which did have fluoride, and I must testify that I was surprised when I came here and found a dentist in Oregon, and even though obviously he knew my background by looking at my address, his first comment to me was, "You have great Midwestern teeth." And I was surprised because I didn't understand what that meant. I thought it was the accent because people say I have an accent even though I don't think I do. And he said, "No, it's obvious that you came from a place that had fluoride and had the minerals, and that's why your teeth are in the shape that they're in." So I can only echo the comments that the board has made that this is a very important health issue to them. From my past knowledge of their past workings with the legislature, they don't often come and testify or request to testify. They do feel this is a very important issue. So I thank the committee, and if there are any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your bringing us the message. Honey.
Thank you.
And I think we have Dick Campbell and Tom Mayer, if I'm not mistaken, the two individuals left, and I need to make an announcement that we had a couple of phone conference calls that we will not be able to get in today. We'll try to finish on time if the gentleman will split the remaining 11 minutes between them, and we'll be in great shape. Please, Mr. Campbell.
Go first? Okay.
Pardon me?
I guess I'm going first.
Yeah, go ahead. That's fine. He'd like to go first for some reason.
Okay, I'm easy. Whatever works.
Well, since I'm on the left side and you always start on the left, I'll go first. My name is Tom Meyer, and I do research and teach at the School of Dentistry at OHSU in Portland. And among my responsibilities is to teach a course entitled Dental Caries, where we introduce the students, the dental students, to the scientific basis of how caries are formed, the bacteria, how does it interact with diet to cause caries. And then, of course, we touch on fluoride and how it works to prevent caries, fluoride toxicity, safety modes of delivery, etc. And I've heard a lot here, and I've only given you one page to look at because I know you guys have a lot to listen to. And the one thing that I think I might be able to help here is maybe talk a little bit about the topical effect of fluoride and how water fluoridation sort of fits into that, because I think there's a lot of misconception exactly where does water fluoridation fit into the topical versus the systemic effect. And I know you know that oral bacteria, when we feed them simple sugars, which we do every day of our life multiple times, I just had a big I had a big Coke and a candy bar before I came in. Please don't tell my students. Every time that happens, the oral bacteria, some of them, metabolize those simple sugars and produce acids, which cause the mineral structure of the tooth to dissolve, essentially. And you lose calcium and phosphates and hydroxyl groups. Luckily, the saliva and thyme and et cetera will remove that acid and allow the tooth structure to sort of rebuild itself. New calcium, phosphates, hydroxyls will fit on. If fluoride is present during that time, it has the opportunity to incorporate itself along with the normal ions at that time. And this happens all the time because of the halo effect, which was mentioned, whether or not you use dental products or not. And as also was mentioned, fluorine atom is the most electronegative element around, and that is the reason why it really works to help strengthen the enamel structure and help it resist the demineralization caused by acids. And the simplest way I have to explain this, and I kind of thought of this on the way down, and as a teacher you have to have props. This was a gift I was given as torture, I think. It's a travel Scrabble gift. It has letters and it has numbers, and you're supposed to take it on long car rides and keep yourself, you know, I can't spell, and there aren't enough points with three-letter words. But nevertheless, it's made out of magnets, and what's cool about magnets is it's just fun. But in essence, that's how the mineral structure of a tooth is held in place. It's simple magnets. These are positively charged, negatively charged ions that attract one another and help form the structure of the tooth. Fluorine being the most electronegative, when it incorporates in optimal amounts, essentially works as a super strong magnet component and holds the structure together more soundly, making it more resistant to the acids and helping it in the remineralization phase. The most effective way for fluoride to affect that, as was been mentioned by both sides in this, and I checked in that box, you know, you're for, against, or neutral, and I really have no horse in this race. Okay, so I checked neutral, but I also checked for because as a scientist and a teacher, I am forced, I must read the literature with a cold, steely eye. And that's my job, and I should teach it that way. And the bulk of the evidence, by far, falls on the pro side. I mean, that's just where it is. And there's been a lot of scientific research on this. And so I'm neutral, you know, but if forced to pick one side, I'm obviously for the four. Fluoridated water works topically once when you drink it down because it obviously passes in the oral cavity and there is at least some time so it can charge up the fluoride content in the mouth. Once you swallow it, however, it's quickly absorbed and gets into the bloodstream, recirculates back into the saliva in relatively small amounts, but the key there is that it's continuous. And the fluoride dribbles back in to the mouth over a matter of hours after you've ingested the water, where it again works topically. And so drinking fluoridated water, by and large, is a topical therapeutic modality. And that's basically. And then yep, I've got some more things about safety and stuff.
Thank you, Doc. Please.
My name's Dick Campbell. I really didn't expect to testify here. I'm a layman. I have no formal scientific training. I'm not a lawyer. There was a lawyer here. I'm a retired conductor, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. I run a 160-acre farm north of Hillsboro and quarter horses and hay. So much for my scientific credentials. I'm not sure how I actually started following this. I've been following this issue for many years. I sat in on a committee hearing during the governorship of former Governor McCaul, who many consider sort of an environmental godfather here in Oregon, and who was an ardent supporter of fluoridation. I remember a legendary legislator, Ted Halleck, chaired the hearings. I don't know what the committee was called, but I've just followed it over the years, and I noticed the term criminal was used earlier in reference to the use of fluoridation. I would reverse that. I would, if that term is a hot-button term, but if it needs to be used, I would suggest that it might maybe criminal not to fluoridate the water supplies. Bottom line is everybody benefits. The low-income people benefit the most. The people that can least afford to go to the dentist, can least afford to eat properly. It just helps everybody. Insurance companies support fluoridation. Every legitimate scientific organization that I've ever heard of supports it. And I don't know. Salem has fluoridation. I don't know. I don't see. I didn't see anybody. suffering in any way. I've never noticed it. So basically, I guess the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency endorses it, and maybe one reason I followed the issue is I saw the movie Dr. Strangelove with Sterling Hayden, did a classic role in that movie and talked about fluoridation, but I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here. And colleagues, I got a little bit of curveball thrown at. We have three people left to testify, and I'm going to stay to hear them testify. You're welcome to stay or you're welcome to leave at your pleasure. But I think it is important that everybody who came today have the opportunity to pass their word on to the committee, and I'm I'm going to extend my time beyond that, but you are excused if you so choose to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I agree with your point. Unfortunately, I have a 3 o'clock.
I appreciate that very much. I mean,
thank you.
Me too. That's fine, Representative. I appreciate everybody here that has been so good about hanging in to get your testimonies in. Okay. So with that, if we could move on as quickly then to Gracie Campbell and Maureen Bolton. Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman, and members, the remaining members. I've submitted written testimony, but I'm here today to read testimony from, this is a statement of the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. To Chairman Jensen and members of the committee, for the sake of the state of Oregon and its children, who are described as the primary beneficiaries of fluoridation, the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, IAONT, urges a no vote on House Bill 2025. Fluoridation is not the appropriate answer for the prevention of tooth decay. Our Academy reviews, supports, and disseminates research on the suitability of dental materials and practices, raising the standards of scientific biocompatibility in dental practice, and provides implementation guidelines for its member dentists and physicians worldwide. In 1998, the IAOMT hosted a risk assessment for ingested fluoride in San Diego, California. At that conference, we heard from 14 scientists, toxicologists, and physicians, including 4 experts from the EPA. The Academy concluded that adding fluoride to municipal water delivers no discernible health benefit and increases the incidence of adverse health effects. The risk assessment was later presented to the International Society for Fluoride Research and published in its journal. For years, dentists believed fluoride had to be swallowed to have benefit. In July 2000, their mainstream journal, JADA, confirmed this assumption was false. Fluoride's primary benefit is not understood to come from its direct topical application on teeth, not systemic ingestion. In its extensive September 1701 report on fluoride, the Centers for Disease Control concurred. When children swallow excessive fluoride, they develop permanently scarred tooth enamel. This condition, called dental fluorosis, is a growing problem in the United States due to fluoride exposure from numerous sources, especially toothpaste and foods, including sodas, juices, cereals, fruits, vegetables grown with fluoride-based pesticides. In response to the growing problem of excessive ingested fluoride, the American Dental Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics adopted new reduced dose recommendations of prescription fluoride for children in non-fluoridated areas. Adding fluoride to Oregon's drinking water will result in mass medication at a higher dosage than these associations now recommend for children under 6. We urge your review of the IAOMT position on fluoridation, which can be accessed at www.iaomt.org. Fluoride is not necessary for excellent tooth health. There are multiple effective approaches to the prevention of tooth decay, which include providing access to dental care for all children, identifying the high-risk children through a simple saliva test, disinfecting high-risk children to prevent a lifetime of disease, teaching parents how to prevent baby bottle tooth decay, improving nutrition in school lunches and eliminating sugars, limiting accessibility to candy and soda vending machines in schools, providing toothbrushing programs following school lunches. We hope you will feel free to contact the IAOMT if we can provide any further information. as you make this critical decision affecting all Oregonians. Respectfully, Richard Shannon, DMD, IAOMT President. And I have one other letter, if there's time.
Please.
Should I read it?
Please.
This is testimony from Joanne Kraft on House Bill 2025. Joanne Kraft, 1610 Alder Street, Portland, Oregon, 16 years independent distributor of Multipure drinking water systems to the chairman and the committee. I have become very knowledgeable about drinking water contaminants and how difficult it is to remove them from our drinking water. I have been tracking the testimony, and no one has raised the issue about the expense involved in avoiding fluoride in your tap water should you choose to or be required to by a doctor. It should be said at the outset that home filtration systems are beyond the means of a significant portion of the population. This raises the question as to whether this is a discriminatory practice which forces people either to be exposed to fluoride or to abandon their water supply. One cannot remove fluoride with a carbon filter because the fluoride ion is so tiny. A person has to buy a technology that is designed to remove minerals / fluoride. A distiller or a reverse osmosis system cost hundreds of dollars and require yearly maintenance. A reverse osmosis system will waste 3 to 5 gallons of water to create 1 gallon of drinking water, obviously increasing the user's water rate. People have different sensitivities to fluoride. If a person could not expose their skin to fluoride, then they would have to purchase a whole house system. This could easily cost thousands of dollars. I'm very aware of the importance of safe drinking water. Many people do not have the means for a fluoride removal system. A person has two choices: spend hundreds of dollars to get the quality of water that they are paying for before fluoridation, or move to a water district without fluoride. The bottom line is arguably that water is our most precious natural resource. Please keep our water as pure as possible. Please vote no on HB, House Bill 2025. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have, would you have copies of those for us?
Yes.
Thank you. Was Maureen Bolton here? I don't think I called your name, sir.
Sorry.
Please, go ahead. Come ahead.
I'm making dance around.
Brent Foster.
I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Oregon Sierra Club. Last week I testified on behalf of Columbia Riverkeeper and Willamette Riverkeeper. I wanted to inform the committee that the Sierra Club has officially taken a position against this bill. And the number one reason why is the contaminant issue. We spent a lot of time and energy working to keep arsenic and lead out of the water. And as I actually think last week's hearing was very telling, I got before you and told you how there was arsenic, lead, chromium, other substances that contaminated the fluoride products. I gave you a sheet that had a big list of them on there and the concentrations that are found in drinking water directly attributable to the addition of fluoride. I understand that seems crazy, and I understand that you didn't believe me at first, but I think I want to refer back, because I think this frames the issue before you, to Representative Dalto's question to Kurt Ferrer when he was here. Mr. Dalto stated what I think we all thought.
It's Representative Dalto.
Apologies. Representative Dalto said, we could never put arsenic or lead or those metals into the water. They'd sue us. We'd have liability. I'm paraphrasing. But that was a general thought, and my thought too. And then he asked Mr. Ferrer, can you tell me how much lead would we be putting in the water in relation to, as a result of fluoride? And Mr. Ferrer responded, consistent with the National Sanitation Foundation letter that I gave you in the chart, that on average, the fluoride products had about 0.44 parts per billion of lead in them. Mr. Dalto's response, I thought you were going to say zero. We all thought he was going to say zero. I would have sworn he would say zero before this ever came about, but he didn't say zero. There is lead in it. There is arsenic. And there's no dispute over the concentrations. The concentrations are in the NSF document. Myself and Mr. Ferrer were relying on the same data. The only question is, what's the effect? What's the meaning of that? And I think this committee, you don't have to listen to me, you don't have to listen to others. What I think you ought to do is convene a panel of people who can tell you. Toxicologists who can say, at this level, lead's not a problem at all, don't worry about it. At this level, arsenic is a problem or it's not a problem. All I ask and all the Sierra Club asks is that you obtain the data before you move this bill forward. If you think that what you're going to see says it's not a problem, then you got nothing to lose. Because you get the data, and then you can say, we did due diligence. The same goes for the effect on salmon. I can sit here and tell you salmon's toxic to fish at 0.21 parts per million. People will testify differently. Bring in Environmental Protection Agency. Bring in DEQ, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Get their opinion on it. I attempted to follow up with Oregon DEQ on several questions related to fluoride concentrations in effluent leaving sewage treatment plants. They were reluctant to talk to me under direction from their bosses saying it has to do with legislation. We're going to keep our mouth shut. So I would love to have additional time, and I think bringing DEQ in or other people to ask those questions. Finally, I would just say I would love to have your questions about why you shouldn't be concerned. I'd love to have you grill me about, you know, why putting chromium or arsenic in water isn't a problem. I just want the committee to address the issue and not pass this forward, because I do think, to the extent this committee would be forcing municipalities to add contaminants to the water, that it is exposing the state to a source of liability, that if you don't look at it from any other perspective, that I would look at it from that perspective. I appreciate your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. I'd like to... please. I have some questions and perhaps some comments. You're obviously a professional lobbyist.
No, that's not true.
What? Pardon me?
That's not true.
You're not being retained by these people?
I am retained by Columbia Riverkeeper and Willamette Riverkeeper. I'm the conservation chair for Oregon Sierra Club, and I work as a volunteer for the Sierra Club.
Being retained would, in my definition here, the point that the chair would like to make with this is, when you represent multiple interests who have basically the same position, would really be appreciative if you put them all in one package and not brought it in and two. The purpose of holding the hearing today, and of course you were almost at the end of the thing and signing up, so it wasn't by design that we called you last, but the purpose was to make sure that the public who hadn't had a chance to testify, you know, were here to testify. So please help me with that in the future. I'd appreciate it an awful lot.
And I understand. And the only reason it came up last with the Sierra Club is literally not until after last week's hearing did they take a position on
okay.
The bill.
All right. I stand corrected.
That's
okay. Excuse me. Thank you. And is there anyone else who wants to say something that came today and hasn't had a chance to say something? Because we're certainly will hold it here. With that, we'll then adjourn until our...